This is Women's Voices and Women's Stories on Yin Radio, and I'm your host, Sandy Billings. October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month. And, of course, now it's fall, so it's a great time to bundle up and watch movies. We've combined these two elements, violence and movies, for today's Yin Radio show, and we're going to talk about those two subjects, and the show is called Movie Violence. I have three pieces for you today. The first is from film director Denise Bennett, who teaches filmmaking at the University of Idaho. She talks with Alex Thornburg about making movies, and in particular, about women making movies. We follow that with two pieces from Yin Radio's newest assistant producer, Renee Pope. Renee watched two films this month about violence and attended discussions about the films. She brings us those discussions and reviews of the documentaries. One is Sin by Silence, a movie about domestic violence in the U.S. The other is Finding Face, which deals with the growing attacks on Cambodian women by throwing acid in their faces. From KRFP Moscow, Idaho, this is Yin Radio, and today our theme is Movie Violence. Our first installment is an overview of movie making. Alex Thornburg interviewed film instructor Denise Bennett in 2008.
Today I'm sitting down with Denise Bennett, senior instructor with the School of Journalism and Mass Media here at the University of Idaho. And today we're going to talk about filmmaking. Thanks for coming in. How's it going?
It's going really good. Thanks for having me.
So filmmaking is a quite vast and complicated world. There are endless categories of filmmaking and endless questions and answers, but in general, what does one need to do to become a filmmaker?
I think the first thing people need to think about is their desire to tell stories. If you're not interested in telling stories, you probably shouldn't become a filmmaker. I think an interest in photography will help anyone that would like to study or make films. Passion to be able to make things, moving pictures.
So how do women fit into the world of filmmaking?
Women are getting better opportunities in terms of the Hollywood industry and film right now, but still Hollywood is predominantly male in terms of people that are actually producing and directing. So in the we're talking about the history of film in the 60s and 70s with the rise of the civil rights movement. You get the rise of the feminist movement. In 1972, the feminist film journal Women in Film was first published in the United States. And then in 1977, you see a little bit of a rise in female stories taking place on screen. In 77, four of the five Best Picture nominated films were about women. And then the fifth film, being Star Wars, had a very, you know, feisty, energetic female lead character with Princess Leia, so things got a little bit better. The complaint with feminist film theorists and critics was that females in American movies were always, you know, primarily a sex object or a sexual plaything for male characters and didn't have anything really serious to say or do in films. So in the 70s and 80s, though, even though the feminist movement is growing, we're not seeing that translated to American movies so much. I think in the 70s and 80s, the really only bankable females in film were actresses, and you're looking at, like, Barbara Streisand, for example. So women weren't really welcomed in Hollywood into directing. In the early days of film, women were either D-girls, which are development girls, you know, that would help getting scripts together to produce. They were hairstylists, they were makeup artists, and the only technical job in the early days of cinema that females in the United States really got were as editors. And editors were, an editing position was considered more of like a crafty thing to do. Like, women could do that because they were good at sewing or quilting, and editing was sort of likened to those types of crafts. But it's getting better now. First female director in Hollywood was Elaine May in 1972, and she worked with Mike Nichols a lot. She was an actress and a screenwriter, and she got a break directing The Heartbreak Kid in 1972, and it totally flopped at the box office. And so we don't really see any fiction features being directed by women so much that made money until the 1980s. And in the 1980s, you get female directors like Martha Coolidge, who did Valley Girl with Nicolas Cage. You get Amy Heckerling, who directs Fast Times at Ridgemont High.
Oh, I didn't even know. I didn't know that that was a female director for that movie.
Yeah, so, and so there was sort of this female perspective on these teen comedies that were coming out in the 1980s, and then Heckerling goes on to direct the Look Who's Talking movies. Coolidge goes on to direct some other, you know, not really great films, but it gave them a chance to start directing. So for the most part, I think even today, you know, current female directors that are really good, Sofia Coppola, the obvious connection there with her father. But for the most part, you see women working independently and primarily in documentary as opposed to fiction features.
Including yourself, I've had another instructor who was into, who did a lot of independent documentary features too. More recently, there's been a kind of a rise in funding available for women, and it hasn't been that way in the past. Like, it's always been, you know, a struggle for women filmmakers, but recently that's kind of turned around, and there's almost, I would almost say, there's more funding out there if you're female.
I think there is more funding for the other. If you are non-white, non-male, non-WASP, you're probably more likely to get funding from various foundations and organizations just because of that fact. So you have organizations like Women in Film, womeninfilm.org, or the Luna Festival, which is a traveling film festival that showcases movies by women, for women, about women. And so any sort of minorities, I think, have a better chance at getting funding than white males.
What resources do independent filmmakers have?
Independent filmmakers simply are funded by their passion to make movies. So I would say, you know, U.S. Bank, Citibank, any sort of credit lending organization is a resource for an independent filmmaker. You know, there's always the National Endowment for the Arts and the National Endowment for the Humanities, but those are really very competitive and you're competing with other art forms, not just filmmaking. So they tend to be very difficult in terms of funding. I think the best thing that independent filmmakers could do if they're trying to just raise a little bit of capital for their movie is to look for private businesses that might be interested in investing there. If you're talking the very low end of the spectrum, there's always the fundraising house party where you get together, a bunch of people send out invitations, provide them with food and liquor if they're so inclined, and get them to donate money with the incentive of them being credited at the end of your film.
So, and then also there's grants out there.
I think for a filmmaker, if you have enough of your own capital to invest to make a good trailer, that's the best way to get funding from a studio or another production company. If you can show them what the movie's going to look like, what the tone is going to be, what the mood is going to be, and that you know what the hell you're doing in terms of directing actors and cutting a film together, that's a good tool for an independent filmmaker that doesn't have a lot of money to be able to show people what they're capable of doing. Speaking of women in film, the Playboy Foundation has a grant, finishing grant, so if you need money to help with music or post-production, you can always apply to the Playboy Foundation, because they're always proponents of women in various sorts of film and photos.
As far as grants go, there's probably more in the way of nonprofits or independent organizations that are going to be providing them as opposed to, like, the government.
It's probably maybe 50-50. You see, like, the Sundance Institute is a great opportunity for people that have their film shot and just need a place to edit and sort of collaborate with other people that will give them feedback to help them shape it. And they also offer money for finishing, like, mixing and sound and music and that sort of thing.
What good and bad personal experiences have you had as a filmmaker? I mean, more specifically as a female filmmaker, but just kind of in general.
Well, I was trying to play the route one time where, you know, let's make a movie by women, for women, about women. And I set out on the road to make a documentary called Biker Chicks about women that ride motorcycles. And so it was an all-female crew, and, you know, we went to up and down the West Coast, California, Oregon, Washington, going to various female biker rallies and just talking to women there and learning about their experiences and hooked up with a woman and decided to follow her to Sturgis, North Dakota for the motorcycle rally there that happens every summer. And on the way, hooked up with some guy, got romantically involved with him, and it kind of changed my feeling about it because it's not, you can't just make a movie that's about women, you know, and you can't just make a movie by women because women and men exist in this earth, you know. I mean, it's just ridiculous to try and delineate the gender that way. And so I thought it was really funny that, you know, I'm setting out trying to make this feminist movie and I get into this relationship with some biker romantically and then it changes my viewpoint about you know, what film is. It's for all people. It's not just for women and men. So I think, you know, it's great that there are opportunities for women, but then at the same time, if we're talking about gender equality, then there should be the same opportunities for men, and that women shouldn't feel like, since they are women, they deserve funding more so than anybody else.
Do you think that they're in, like, this day and age, do you think that it's getting closer to an equal opportunity for just kind of everyone in filmmaking?
I really do. I think it is equal opportunity. I just think it happens to be a fact that men are more interested in this line of work as a teacher of production, be it film, television, radio, what have you. I would say I've been teaching for 10 years. And in the past 10 years, 25% of my students are female and 75% are male. So it tends to be something that men want to do more so than women.
Yeah, I remember studio production class with you. We had 100%. I think we had 100% males.
So did. I was the only female there. Yeah. I mean, now in a class of 24 students, I have four that are female.
Filmmaking's hard to get into for anybody, and it's kind of getting to the point where it's a bit more of an even standard.
The advances in technology in terms of digital technologies allows anyone and everyone to make movies, and you can post them on YouTube and start, you know, internet distribution and so forth. However, just because technology is getting cheaper and more accessible doesn't mean that everyone should be making films. But yeah, I think the playing field has definitely evened it out. But I think, you know,
just because you're got a video on YouTube doesn't mean you're going to be the next big Hollywood director.
Exactly. So. And it's not so much, I think that film students a lot of times get obsessed with the technical aspects of it and the things you can do with equipment. But if you don't have a story to tell and you don't have a point of view, then nobody cares what your shot looks like or how great your sound mix is, because we're really interested in stories that are about humanity.
All right, well, thanks for coming in today.
Thanks for having me.
Once again, that was Denise Bennett with the School of Journalism and Mass Media here at the University of Idaho. And I'm Alex Thornburg for Yin Radio. Thanks for tuning in.
That kicks off our movie show, and we are going to continue on with movie violence. Next up is Sin by Silence. In order to promote domestic violence awareness, Alternatives to Violence of the Palouse, which is a local rape and domestic violence crisis center, held a screening of the documentary Sin by Silence. Sin by Silence offers a gateway into the lives of women who are domestic violence's living worst-case scenarios, women who have killed their abusers. While most of the women in Sin by Silence may remain in prison for the remainder of their lives, these women are committed to helping others understand the reality of domestic violence. Through their stories of terror and hope, the viewer can begin to understand the cycles of violence, the signs of an abuser, and how each and every one of us is responsible for changing the tragedy of domestic violence. Inside the California Institution for Women, the first inmate-initiated and led group in U.S. prison history shatters the misconceptions of domestic violence. This group is Convicted Women Against Abuse. It was created in 1989 to help women inside prison break the silence about abuse and to learn more about what they needed to do to help others stop the cycle of violence. Instead of fighting a system that does not fully comprehend the complexities of abuse, the women of Convicted Women Against Abuse led an initiative to help educate the system. Through careful orchestration of letter-writing campaigns, media coverage, and Senate hearings, a movement was born and laws for battered women were changed. And the founder of CWAA As for her, the flicker of hope begins to grow as her possible freedom after 26 years in prison lies just moments away. After the documentary aired here in Moscow, Idaho, there was a panel discussion involving Emily McLarnon, the assistant director of Alternatives to Violence of the Palouse, police officer Rick Whitmore from the Moscow Police Department, and pastor Dave Deckard of Genesee. Yin Radio's Renee Pope attended the movie and the panel session, and she learned that domestic violence isn't discussed very much. Pastor Deckard gives a great explanation.
You know, the thing that's difficult, I think, is that we're not prepared for this. Most people aren't prepared to accept that this happens. I've spent more than a decade in small town ministry, talking towns under 1,000. Rural areas are very prevalent for abuse because you can be isolated there. You can go out on a farm and there's no one within half a mile. If you don't give someone the car keys, they don't go, right? We're not prepared to accept this happens. We're not prepared to reach out and notice what's happening to our neighbors. We're not prepared before someone comes to hear these stories. No one's going to come if they don't think you're going to listen. They can't tell. It's a silence, right? We're not prepared. I'm certainly not prepared or wasn't prepared as a minister to start dealing with this when it came up. I think you saw in the film that the legal system, law enforcement, not prepared. And we have to somehow become prepared. We have to stop reacting to things after they happen. And we have to be open and willing to step out before things are happening and as things are happening and say, safety is important, respect and dignity are important, and we have to live our lives to make that a reality now.
Yeah, it's not really fair to expect law enforcement to deal with the problem by themselves, is it?
Right, or Alternatives to Violence, or a church, or, I mean, this takes everyone, students, and grocery store clerks, and people understanding that this is a reality. And it takes, you know, 12 people informing 12 others that inform 48 others, and so on, until we admit that this is real and how tragic it is.
An audience member asked a great question involving the laws that are in place for victims of domestic violence. A person from the prosecutor's office wasn't able to make it to the panel, so Officer Whitmore shared his knowledge on the subject.
My expertise is not in case law. I can tell you, I touched on it briefly, that being a law enforcement officer in Washington for 12 years and then coming here, that this is the good old West. Sometimes I just shake my head and I don't quite understand why it is the old West. And the domestic violence laws are more, for police officers when it comes to responding, user-friendly, so that we can be more effective when you go to a call, when you go to a situation where someone needs to be arrested or be in a safe place. Now, when we go in Idaho, when we respond, if someone's committed a domestic battery, and we reach the point of probable cause, and husband hits wife, and she's got a red mark across her face, he's going to go to jail. That doesn't differ, okay? And when it comes to battery and laws in Washington and Idaho, they're both either misdemeanors or gross misdemeanors, depending on the type of injury. In Idaho, there's just felonies and misdemeanors. There's no, in Washington, there's different degrees for instance, in Washington, there's 4 degrees of assault. In Idaho, we call it battery, but there's battery and battery, and there's aggravated battery, which jumps it up to a felony, but pretty much battery is domestic battery as well. We do have laws that say, you know, define what domestic battery is, but pretty much it just basically defines What is domestic battery when it considers people living under the same roof? Girlfriend, boyfriend, daughter, son, husband, wife.
After hearing how behind the times Idaho's laws are in regards to domestic violence, I wondered what are some ways we as citizens can help to get the laws changed so that victims have more support.
We can work on a local level to contact our state representatives. There's also the, becoming informed on these issues and how they look in other states. Like, I know in the paper there's story after story after story about domestic violence and domestic homicide, and it's easy, you read it, it's like, oh my gosh, it's this horrible story, and it's just to pay more attention to those and see what the trends are and see what kinds of things are happening and pay attention to the sentencing that might be mentioned in those articles and become more informed in general and be able to discuss that. But really, we do have, our state does have a small population, so citizens can make a difference, at the state level, and have.
I would agree with that. We are a small state. To give you an idea, we're just a little over 1 million people, mm-hmm. And in King County, King County in the Seattle area, it's 3. So, good grief. I think that the legislators, if you contact them, I think that they're not, certainly in Washington, they're being bombarded by many, many people. I think that you might have a stronger voice here.
And I think another thing, too, is just being informed about the issues, because I think that one of the things that in Idaho and maybe in Moscow in particular, we think like, oh, we live in Moscow and it's like different than the rest of Idaho, but we live in a state that has very different laws than other states, and people don't know that we don't have, that we have very different rape laws than Washington. People don't know that we don't have all the types of protection orders that you can get in Washington. People don't know that we don't have a mandatory arrest law, because they don't experience it every day. And so if it doesn't affect them, they just kind of, move through life as it goes unnoticed. And so I think that a big thing is just knowing, being informed about domestic violence and sexual assault issues in Idaho, and sharing that and getting people, and I'm not saying you have to go, get upset, but like, get upset. Get upset that we don't have the protection that we need, and that our officers' hands are tied when they go to a situation that is, that other states, we have good examples of what other states, and I mean, Washington is a great example because it's close, but there's a lot of states that have really progressive laws around domestic violence and sexual assault. And so I think that's a big thing too, is just knowing the laws and helping people around you understand that, and then making a difference with those people, because we sometimes think if it doesn't affect us, it's not a big deal, or we don't even know.
Virginia Solon, an ATVP staff member, went into more specific detail with Idaho laws and how they affect the support offered to victims.
I can tell you, I've been working as an advocate for 20 years in courts in Oregon, Washington, and Idaho, and I can tell you that Idaho is a completely different animal than the other two states, and that people are safer in Washington and Oregon than they are in Idaho because of that. There are more options for protection orders and things like that in other states than there are in Idaho, and the burden of proof is much lower than it is in Idaho. We find that across the state, judges are reluctant to grant those protection orders that are supposed to be so helpful because of a federal law that came down that was supposed to be very helpful, that said if you had a protection order against you, you couldn't have a firearm. Well, that made judges in Idaho say, well, gee, if you can't have a firearm, you can't go hunting. And so it has to be pretty darn bad to take away this guy's guns. And I can tell you, I've been in courtrooms where judges have said, well, sure, he tried to run you down, and the children were in the car, and he totally, he smashed the driver's side door off, But he didn't actually hit you, so there was no physical injury, and so I don't think that rises to the level of domestic violence. Protection order denied. And I've seen it over and over and over again. So I can't speak to the sentencing and all that, but I can tell you on the side of people trying to get help, it makes jobs for people that are the initial responders, like Officer Whitmore and the rest of us, it makes it very difficult. And people say, well, why do women go back? Oftentimes, there's not a lot of support out there for them if they try to get some help. It's very, very difficult. If they ever want to see their children again, then they need to stay with that abuser. And that unfortunately, is the scenario for a lot of people. But there are options for them, and that's what we want people to know. If you exercise your options and you use the system intelligently and you use advocates and you use law enforcement, then you really do have a really good potential for a good outcome. It's just that when you try to do it all by yourself, it's really difficult. And then there are the people who, sure, they know there are options available, but what if it's an issue of faith? What if they've been raised to feel that, you know, divorce is against what God wants? Well, then what do you do? You know, it can get to be really complicated. I've had a number of clients who were afraid to leave because they wanted to leave and all, but they were convinced that their abuser would kill their mother in another state, something like that. I know where your family is. I will find them. Maybe I won't find you, but I will make the people that you care about pay. You know, there are all kinds of insidious ways that you can intimidate people that can make it really difficult, and you can say, what is she doing staying there? But, you know, maybe if you were in her shoes, it would be really, really difficult to leave, especially if you care a lot about other people that might be being threatened. And that's one thing that we really urge, too, that if you have a friend in the situation or a family member, to call us and urge them to call us, because they often go to friend or family's home for protection, and that's not a safe thing to do. And we have our 24-hour shelter, so we have options for people that are safe, and they don't need to go to their friends and family and put them at risk.
Many of us wouldn't know the first thing about how to support victims in this situation. Emily offers some tangible ways people can become advocates and what to do if someone does come to you for support.
We talk about that a lot with younger people, particularly in the high schools, and you know how to help a friend and kind of breaking it down to that level that even four-year-olds can understand. You know, how to be a good friend, but really it carries over in this kind of thing where, you know, to get that person to open up is to kind of, you know, you have to be kind of a not non-judgmental, but being an open person and be willing to ask that question. Are you okay? You know, are you safe at home? And, you know, to ask those tough questions. If a relationship is healthy and okay, then asking those questions isn't going to make it not okay. So there's that, and there's also, you know, I think just being open to the fact that it can happen anywhere and to anyone, not thinking, well, it's not going to happen to people like my friends, because my friends are going to know not to get involved with things like that. And, you know, it's a pretty good way to shut down a victim if they hear the people they're close to saying, you know, those, you know, if they'd only do this, or to, you know, to be kind of harsh when they hear about a case of abuse. So not saying we have to accept everything, every incident, but to be an open person, and also to know that you don't have to be an expert, that you can call our hotline and get help. You can call the police and ask them for help. You can call, you know, different friends. It's just helping the victim to open up and to reach out and not be so isolated.
I think the most important thing to do if you have a friend or a family member who's struggling with this stuff is just to validate them that no matter what they're going through and what their choices are, that you believe that they're doing the best that they possibly can at that time, and just reinforce for them that they have options and that you care about them and that you're being non-judgmental. That's super important. People need to feel like they've got that place to go.
There are many ways in which you can make a difference in someone's life that's going through this struggle. ATVP is always accepting volunteers for their hotline. Another simple way you can help is by fostering animals of victims who are trying to find a way out of their abusive situation.
We have a real barrier with pets, and we don't have enough pet fostering places. And lots of times, there was a recent study done where This researcher went to shelters all over the country, and he interviewed women who had wanted to leave an abusive situation before, and they did not leave, and asked them why they did not leave, and it was because of their pets. The abuser had threatened to kill the pets, torture the pets, whatever, if they left, and there was no place to put the pets. And these can be horses, too, you know, so they can be hard to place. But oftentimes, you know, a pet is the one thing in the victim's life that they feel close to and a connection with or have that unconditional love from, and so their pet is everything to them.
On a final note, no one deserves to be abused, period. Pastor Descartes made a great statement about this. Whether you have faith or not, the message is extremely powerful, and I think it applies to every one of us.
We are God's children, and we are supposed to love each other and respect each other because God loves us a lot. And if someone is doing something to you that takes away that sense of love and dignity and safety, that's ungodly. It just is, and it has to stop. And maybe there are mitigating circumstances, whatever you want to talk about, but at the end of the day, that's not okay in anybody's faith that I know of.
For more information about the film or for ways to get involved, please go to www.sinbysilence.com and atvp.org.
On this Yin Radio show, we're exploring two elements, violence and movies. October was Domestic Violence Awareness Month, and it provided opportunities to learn about, talk about, and take steps to eliminate violence against women.
Hello. Hello.
Cloud by Bridge Underwater, who produces lo-fi music in Philadelphia. Installment number 3 is Finding Face. This is a documentary about acid violence against women in Cambodia. Renee Pope talked to the filmmakers Sky Fitzgerald and Patty Duncan.
The University of Idaho Women's Center held a screening and fundraiser of the documentary Finding Face October 14th at the Kenworthy Theater in downtown Moscow. The film contextualizes acid violence in Cambodia as both a human rights violation and a gender-based form of violence. In it, human rights workers and survivors of acid attacks discuss the many challenges faced by victims, as well as what they see as a culture of impunity surrounding violence against women. They also discuss the rise in acid violence following a much-publicized attack in Cambodia, a result of the public's awareness that perpetrators are unlikely to face any serious penalties. Sky Fitzgerald and Patty Duncan are the filmmakers. Here, Patty discusses how she and her partner got involved in the project.
I went to visit my partner in Cambodia, and while I was there, I was introduced to this issue of acid attacks and acid violence. As my partner and I decided that we would do a short film that could be used as a resource by the main human rights organization in the country that was working on the issue. Once we met with some of the staff at that organization, it became really clear to us that they lacked resources that we had access to. And so our initial plan was to do a 10-minute film that would be something that they could use to publicize the issue, to raise awareness within the country, and to hopefully get people to intervene or to stop these attacks.
If you are like me, and this is the first you're hearing about this issue, it's hard to understand why this is happening. Patty explains the most common reasons these women are being attacked.
They often target young women who are seen as somehow allegedly transgressing gender or sexual norms, or who are considered outspoken or unfeminine, or somehow not playing by the rules of gender norms. And we've seen them often targeting women who are doing things like being involved with birth control movements, in education movements, women who have refused to marry, women who have turned down marriage proposals.
The film details the controversial case of Top Marina, who was attacked with acid in Cambodia in 1999. At 16, Marina was a rising star in Phnom Penh's karaoke music scene. She was coerced into an abusive relationship with Cambodia's Undersecretary of State, Svai Sita, and subsequently doused with a liter of nitric acid, allegedly by his wife, that disfigured her face. A decade later, despite the fact that there were multiple witnesses to the crime, no charges have ever been filed in the case.
As we started talking to people and meeting with survivors and human rights workers and feminist activists on the issue, it became really clear that it was a much bigger topic and a much bigger project. And everybody kept mentioning this one case, Tet Marina. Everybody said, you have to talk to Tet Marina. You can't do a film on this topic in this country without focusing on the case of Tet Marina. And so we tried to seek out Tet Marina, who had actually come to the U.S. and was granted asylum to enter the U.S. for medical treatment. And it was a very complicated story. Some of it is covered in the film, so I won't go over all of it now. But basically, in short, she was coerced into a sexual relationship with Cambodia's Undersecretary of State when she was 14 years old. She was a rising star in the karaoke music scene in Cambodia, which is a way that a lot of young women can get fame and can get access to things like resources and money. And she was one of these young women who had been recruited into the music scene and was basically supporting her entire family financially at the age of 14 and 15. When she became involved with Svai Sita, the Undersecretary of State, he basically made threats against her and her entire family. When she attempted to leave him, as we attempt to show in the film, there were more threats made against her. Her attack was actually perpetrated by his wife in a public marketplace in front of, like I said, hundreds of people. Nobody was ever held accountable for the attack. The arrest warrant went missing. The vehicle at the scene of the attack was returned to Svai Sita. She was eventually granted asylum to come to the U.S. because her brother had been a refugee and was living in the Boston area. And so we made contact with Tet Marina to tell her about the project that we were embarking on. And up to that point, she had not really spoken publicly about her attack. It had been several years since her attack. She's still obviously a very young person and was struggling over the loss of her, not only her face, right, but her country, her family, her culture, her language, everything. And she was basically living in obscurity and poverty in the Boston area, unable to hold down a job and trying to figure out how to survive. When we made contact with her, she initially was very, very afraid. And she said, I can't be involved in anything like this. I have to put it behind me. I'm afraid for my family. I'm afraid for myself. Knowing that the people who are still in power in Cambodia have done a lot to cover up her attack and her case. So we kind of dropped the issue, and we were trying to decide whether to, you know, whether to even pursue this project. We didn't want to put her in any kind of jeopardy. We didn't want to put her family into any kind of jeopardy. About a month later, she called me out of the blue, and she said, I want to make this film with you. I want you to tell my story. I feel like I want the world to know what happened to me. So we started working with her on the project. We started working closely with her brother, and we made several trips back and forth to Cambodia to interview members of her family as well, who all came on board when she told them what she was doing. And everybody got involved in the project and decided that it was something that they all wanted known to the world. So that was kind of a little bit of the backstory. Marina collaborated with us on the project. She narrates parts of the film. Her brother narrates other parts of the film. For her, it was a really important story because, of course, it's her life story, but it's also her attempt to seek some form of justice, whatever that might look like. Part of making this film, of course, did put her family into jeopardy. And they all knew that, and they willingly decided to be part of the process. So we were able to engage the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, who had people step in and remove members of her family from the country. So they are currently in hiding in a different country, waiting for, hopefully, access to come here to be rejoined with Marina and her brother Sequando, which is the hope, I think, for everybody.
Not only was this film made to provide some sort of justice for the victims and their families by exposing this violence to the world, it was also made to be used as a tool.
One of the ways in which we've been using this film as a tool is to try to put pressure on governments like the U.S. government to allow the members of her family into the country. The film is also, of course, being used as a tool, hopefully, to put pressure on the government of Cambodia to actually reopen this case and to look at subsequent cases of acid violence against women in the country and to take them seriously. So we premiered the film in March in Switzerland at the UN Human Rights Film Fest, and her family was able to get out of the country the day before we premiered the film there. And since then, our website has been banned in Cambodia, and some people have found access to the film and released it illegally within the country, which we were hoping would happen. And we've been bombarded. We've gotten at least 300 to 400 requests from people in Cambodia, including many progressive activists and younger people and students, asking for access to the film and wanting to be able to know the story so that they can be part of putting that pressure on the government. But in the meantime, one of our short-term goals has been to use whatever funding, you know, to use the film to raise money in whatever way we can.
This is a global issue that is happening not only in, quote, other countries, but is also happening in Europe and the United States. So why is this becoming such a common form of violence against women?
As cases like Marina's kind of get left there with no real attention and no prosecution and no form of accountability, there's this sense of a lack of justice, and I think there's this idea that it's okay to attack women with acid. It's an expedient form of violence. And I think, you know, we could talk about how we have more crimes here in this country involving guns against women, right? Because that's an expedient form of violence. In Cambodia, in Bangladesh, for example, acid is really cheap and available. It's a very, you know, you can buy it in parts of Cambodia for $2 a liter. You know, I like to try to place that into context and to think about it in a way that doesn't do more violence to the issue or to the survivors by turning it into something in which Cambodian culture can be seen as at fault, which it's not. So instead, I'm trying to kind of look at some of the political, social, economic forces that contribute to acid violence, not only in Cambodia, but all over the world.
The film also discusses another survivor of an acid attack, Choi Sraya, who doesn't hide her scars and instead has become an activist for survivors.
She was attacked when she was 20 years old. She was a former beauty contestant pageant, and she worked in a restaurant serving beer. And many young women find jobs in restaurants as beer girls, that's what they're called, where they basically represent a particular brand of beer. And men will buy the beer based on often the appearance of the young women. And so she was also considered an amazingly intelligent woman who really wanted to go to college. She was hoping that this would enable her to raise enough money to go to school and continue her education. One day, she was leaving the restaurant with four of her women friends, and they were all on the stairs outside of the restaurant in the Central Market area. When a man approached them, he drove up on a motorbike, jumped off the motorbike, and he had what she believes was kind of like a big Sprite bottle. And he took it and he threw it in their faces. And she happened to be in the center of her group of friends and caught the most of the attack. All of them were scarred in some way, but Sraya was blinded by the attack. And you can see that it basically hit her on top of the head, ran down her face, burned her chest and her arms as well. She does not know why she was attacked. She did not recognize the perpetrator. She doesn't know if the attack was intended for her or one of her friends. She really doesn't know. And her father at the time was a police officer, and even he could not get anyone to take the case seriously. It was never investigated. He left the force after that because he was so devastated by that injustice. She told me that she spent about 3 months feeling deeply suicidal. Then she learned Braille, and she learned massage. Since then, Sraya has married. She married a man. She works at the Association for the Blind in Cambodia, giving massage. And she married a coworker, and they had a baby 2 years ago. She feels like she is living her dream, and she's been able to support her family by giving massage, and her one big concern has been continuing some kind of medical treatment. She needed to have surgery on a few parts of her face that she was never able to afford, and so far the fundraising we've been able to do for the film has paid for 3 surgical procedures for her. So she is 29 now, and like I said, she's just phenomenal. She's probably the bravest person I've ever met. What I love about Chor Sraya is that she says, you know, look, I'm as happy and as confident now as I was before. And I think that she forces us to see survivors not simply as downtrodden victims, but as people who are strong and resisting oppression. And she's done a great job. She organized a women's support group. They meet about once a month, and she actively recruits survivors to come to this group and seeks them out and tries to help other women not feel so isolated and alone.
After watching this film, I noticed a lot of guilt and blame is placed on the victims in these crimes. I wondered why.
A lot of people talk about the issue in terms of karma. And it's a Buddhist society, and one of the big barriers has been the way that karma, the idea or the concept of karma, is often twisted around to be used against the survivors of acid attacks. And I think even more disheartening is that many of the survivors we talked with actually said themselves, this is because of my karma. I did something really bad in a former life. So that is, I guess that would be the main religious undertone. Even Sraya said in an early interview that she believes that her karma must have been really bad. I think that's just an idea or an ideology that is very deeply ingrained.
As stated before, a large reason this has become such a popular act of violence against women is because there is a lack of justice. Patty mentioned that less than 15 cases have been prosecuted and only a couple people have been arrested for acid throwing, and they were women.
The majority of perpetrators of acid throwing are men attacking women. Of course, it's really about power, you know, and as long as it's a more powerful person attacking a less powerful person, nothing will ever be done.
Top Marina, who was granted asylum to enter the U.S., struggles to emerge from a shattered self-image and escape a constant state of fear. She breaks her long silence with the hope that she can gain some form of justice, if not in the state judicial system, then at least in the court of public opinion. Patty Duncan is Associate Professor of Women's Studies at Oregon State University, where she specializes in transnational feminist movements, women of color studies, Asian, Asian American women, and intersections of race, gender, class, sexuality, and nation. She received her BA from Vassar College and her MA and PhD from Emory University. She is the author of Tell This Silence, Asian American Women Writers in the Politics of Speech, and numerous articles, essays, and reviews. She is a member of several local, national, and international social justice organizations. Dr. Duncan is also a member of APA Compass, a public affairs radio collective on KBOO 90.7 FM, where she produces programming relevant to Asian Pacific American communities. She served as associate producer on the film Bomb Hunters and co-produced for Switch, A Community in Transition. If you would like more information about this global issue, please go to www.findingface.org.
And that installment comes from Renee Pope, Yen Radio's newest assistant producer, covering the documentary Finding Face. We're going to wrap up this Yin Radio show about movie violence with music by Alison Krow. First, I want to let you know that you can listen to past shows or podcast this show, or you can sign up for our electronic newsletter at yinradio.org. You can drop us a line at yinradio@vpfound.org. That's yinradio at V as in voice, P as in power, found.org. Yin Radio is produced at KRFP Radio Free Moscow in Moscow, Idaho. I am Sandy Billings, your executive producer and host. Assistant producers are Renee Pope and Alex Thornburg. Opening music is by Piano Chocolat. Yin Radio is a production of VP Foundation. Thanks for joining me. Until next week.
Shove it, ask for the pain. Well, I love it, Lord. Eat your words, I'll devour your soul. I will laugh like a lemur while you crawl back into your hole. I won't deny you, but I'll pay you no heed. And if you keep stabbing me, I will probably bleed. But I'll pretend I'm a cloud. Bit off, but you can't leave, you can't open the door. You think you're unique, but I've seen you before. So run away while the fires that burn. You will do this again and again, but you will never learn. So keep looking down as you crush me, keep smiling, cause I will get up, and there's no denying that I am one of your little punching.